My guest, John Zwett, is the author of a new biography of Miles Davis called So What, named after the Miles composition. In the introduction, Zwett acknowledges that several biographies of the great jazz trumpet player have already been written. Zwett says he has tried to write a meditation on Miles Davis's life. It's been 11 years since Miles died, and as Zwett points out, he still seems omnipresent. We refer to him by his first name in acknowledgement of his pervasive influence. At jazz festivals, Miles Davis tributes outdraw newer musicians' performances. Trumpeters still copy his playing. John Zwett is also the author of the books Jazz 101 and Space is the Place, a biography of the jazz composer and musician Sun Ra. And he's a professor of African American Studies, Music, and American Studies at Yale. Let's start with music. This is Miles Davis's 1954 recording of the Rodgers and Hart song, It Never Entered My Mind. John Zwett, welcome to Fresh Air. Miles, during this period, gravitated towards songs and show tunes. Can you talk a little bit about why he loved to play those songs?
Yeah, he particularly was fond of, early on, some singers who are not so well known anymore. But Blossom Dearie comes to mind, and Jerry Southern, and Shirley Horn, who's still very much with us, and Helen Merrill later on. And these are singers that basically are slow burners, sort of low vibrato chanteuses who worked a certain kind of song so slowly, as Shirley Horn said, no one could tell where the one was, where the downbeat was when they sang. And in a sense, they keep the romantic quality of the songs, but they move them to a new place. And what's outrageous, I guess, in the time when Miles was doing this stuff first, which was, what, the early 50s, is that this is a period after bebop had effaced those tunes, had sort of hidden them with these melodies, what should I say, signified on these melodies and made them something else. And here comes Miles, and then later Chet Baker, turning this corner of saying, hey, we can play these tunes straight.
At some point when Miles started to move away from songs, you quote him as saying he didn't want to be restricted by the breath limits of singers and the restrictions of word phrases. Do you think that when he moved away from songs, he started playing the kind of music that wouldn't work as song, that singers couldn't sing, that wasn't adapted at all for the voice?
Yeah, and in that he was not alone. And that, in talking mid-60s again, you could have heard this first a little earlier in Ornette Coleman and some of the so-called free jazz players who were also escaping those sort of two- and four-bar phrases that in which singers sang and which the lyricists wrote for. And oddly enough, or maybe appropriately enough, this is a period also where poets began to think in larger breath units, which is to say, go out to the end of the line and see how far you can go, or even write, in the case of Ginsberg, write out to the end of the page and then stop and start over again.
What do you consider to be the first important record in his move away from song?
Well, as an entire album, Kind of Blue, which is still his mega best-selling kind of piece of music, because they began to think in terms of, instead of the usual pop song forms, in terms of modes and other approaches to it. So there were, it was a kind of elasticity built into it. They could play for a short time, they could play for a long time.
Do you want to choose a piece from Kind of Blue?
Yeah, one of Flamenco Sketches.
Okay, here it is. Thank you. That's from the Miles Davis album Kind of Blue, recorded in 1959. My guest, John Zwett, is the author of the new book, So What? The Life of Miles Davis. A lot of Miles Davis's early music had a very beautiful, romantic sound to it. You've spoken to some of the women who were either married to Miles Davis or spent some time as lovers with him. Was he a romantic lover in the way you might expect him to be listening to those beautiful records?
I think there was that element there. Clearly, the music communicated a certain kind of character, and many people said to me that when they found that he was that his character was not quite in line with those songs, that, to put it mildly, that they were surprised. They thought he was what he played. In fact, a sort of Miles school trumpet player, Art Farmer, said Miles played the way he wanted to be. And this is a bad aesthetic and bad emotional mistake to treat things that way. And they always thought, at least some of them thought, that that must be his core self somewhere, and all he needed to do was to be with the right woman to have it surface. This turns out not to have been such an easy course for many people, because particularly under the influence of cocaine, which produced severe paranoia in Davis for years, that he could be very violent and extremely difficult, not just with women, but with men. But it does suggest that it went very deep into the way he related to people.
What's an example of how his paranoia was expressed through his actions?
He was delusional, I think, at worst points. So, as he himself said, he thought an elevator was his car, and then people got inside. He wondered what they were doing in his car. He thought people were, this was very common with him, he thought people were under rugs, under furniture, and before he'd feel safe, he'd have to go check these things out. He mistook snow on the ground for being cocaine. He stepped through windows and doors. It was severe delusion, and he spells a good deal of this out in his own autobiography. Despite those kind of problems of use, he nonetheless took care of business, as they would say. He showed up at recording sessions early. He was organized, in spite of the kind of strange organization that he used, which was very often, I'm going to make all the space in the world for you, and you better come through. His sense of knowing how to arrange people is no small skill. I say arrange people because that's what he was doing rather than music. He knew how to bring the best out of himself and other people. So it's really quite extraordinary to see this balancing act going on where he can barely stand up at some points, and yet he can produce this incredible music.
Talk a little bit more about what you mean by he didn't arrange music, he arranged people.
Well, this doesn't happen very often in the arts, I think. You know, we talk about improvisation, and that's usually an individual kind of thing, and there's some talk in the theater about it, but there's always a kind of structure to this that's more there than we're led to believe sometimes. But a few times, musicians have attempted to bring people into a studio and see what would happen. Apparently, according to Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan did this in one case, filling a studio with 20-some people, and nothing happened. In fact, they just irritated each other, and Dylan kept running out for more people. But Miles did the same kind of thing. In any number of sessions, starting in the late 60s particularly, he would bring people in who didn't even know that other people would be there, so they would sometimes have three or four keyboardists turn up and three drummers, all staring at each other and wondering, where do I sit, what do I do, and so forth. And when asked, what do I do, as one drummer asked one time when he was staring at the other two, he said, we'll let Jack DeJohnette lead the drum section because he's the one wearing the sunglasses, that kind of thing. Or when asked, what do we play on this tune, as John McLaughlin, the guitarist, asked one time, he said, play like you've never played guitar before. Play like you don't know how to play. The famous remark to Herbie Hancock, sit on your left hand, and then at one point, sit on your right, too. When asked, what should I play? If you don't know, don't play anything. This ability to bring people in like that, and then when he did have music, something like Joe Zawinul's In a Silent Way, he erased the chords, so he took the basic structure of the piece out, opening up the possibility for all sorts of things to happen. I think this may not be so striking to other people, but to me at least, the degree of seriousness of the man about what he was doing was stunning. His approach to this music was that of an intellectual and a purist, although it's very hard to make that case to many people who don't know this music that well. It's hard to find an artist more devoted to what he's doing than what Davis brought to this. It's often chaotic. It's often destructive in a variety of ways. But this is a man who wants to do something perfectly, and he wants to get it to sound like nothing's ever been heard before. And that's the reason they continue to change music. He was, I thought, rather modestly said once at the White House when someone said, "What did you do to get invited here?" He said, I think it was the elder Bush's White House, he said, "I changed music 4 or 5 times. What did you do other than sleep with a white man?" I believe the line went. I count that he's changed the music 6 or 7 times, maybe 8 if you want to be a part of that.
Well, John Sweat, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Sweat is the author of the new book, So What? The Life and Times of Miles Davis. This is Fresh Air.